The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
4th of July deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, including the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator, featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Now's the perfect time to upgrade your home with top Samsung appliances and hot 4th of July savings at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. As her ship skirted the Statue of Liberty and headed toward Ellis Island, Isabella Needy hadn't seen her husband and oldest son in 3 years. It was 1916, and she had escaped Europe at war to finally reunite with her family in America. But what awaited Sabelle, as she was usually called, was not the American dream she likely envisioned. Like millions of other immigrants in the decades following the American Civil War, the Needys hoped for a better life than the one they had left behind in southern Italy. But Sabelle's new life looked shockingly like her old one. Once she and the younger children traveling with her joined her husband Francesco and oldest son James in Chicago, they traveled to their farm outside the city. Technically in the town of Stickney, the next 6 years saw Sabelle so isolated that there was no need for her to learn English. She had two more children and worked alongside her sons and hired hands on their struggling farm. Then her husband Francesco disappeared in 1923. Sabelle still had to make sure work on the farm got done, because that's how life on a farm works. Even when there's a crisis, shit's got to get done. As the weeks passed with no sign of Francesco, the farm survived thanks to the work done by Sabelle, her children, and their field hand, Peter Crudell. Cook County Sheriff Paul Dasso grew suspicious. With no sign of Francesco or his body, the sheriff arrived at the Needy Farm on September 14, 1922, to take both Sabelle and Peter into custody, supposedly not for Francesco's death, but on drummed-up charges of adultery and fornication, even though Peter lived in a shack on the property and there was no evidence for these charges. Without a body, Dasso needed a confession to wrap everything up in a tidy bow. And he wanted that confession, regardless of whether Sabelle or Peter actually committed any crime. Within weeks of the arrests, investigators in Cook County stopped looking for Francesco's body, leading Chicago residents to believe that the scandalous couple were also guilty of murder. But it should be noted, a grand jury wasn't convinced of that, so Sabelle and Peter were released from jail in December of 1922. And then strangers finally stumbled upon a body in May 1923. Cook County charged Sabelle and another of Sabelle's sons, Charles, for the murder of Francesco. Over the next 18 months, the case of Sabelle Needy would illustrate the xenophobia and sexism of 1920s Chicago. Yet very few know her name, as if she's been erased from the records, overshadowed by more infamous cases. Leopold and Loeb comes to mind. While incarcerated, Sabell lived in a cell block so infamous that a journalist set a play there in the 1920s, which later was turned into a musical and then a movie, the latter of which boasted a famous tango featuring a singular immigrant woman who fiercely maintained her innocence. But while that character was based on Sabell Needy, very little of her real story or her ending matched real life. To steal from another musical, Hamilton, it's about time Sabell Needy be written back into her own narrative.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
To be clear, there was no evidence that Sabell Needy and her field hand, Peter Crudell, had been sleeping together before Sabell's husband went missing, and them being charged with fornication did not mean much in this era. Here's author Emily Lucchese, who wrote the book Ugly Prey about this case.
After her husband went missing, that awful Sheriff Dasso came up with this ridiculous adultery charge, which came up in Illinois in the mid-1800s for when Mormon settlers were moving through. It was the adultery charge was a way to get them to keep moving by saying you couldn't openly live out with someone outside your marriage. Peter was just a farmhand, but it was a way for Dasso to lock them up.
I'll mention, by the way, that in Ugly Prey, the author calls Sabell Sabella, but the newspaper coverage of the time skewed towards Sabell in about a 3-to-1 ratio, so I'm going with that instead. Either might be right, or both, I'm not sure. Anyway, Sabell and Peter did end up getting married. It seems they decided that getting hitched would get their fornication charges dropped and allow Peter to stay on the farm and keep his job. Regardless the reason, by the time they were arrested, Sabell's surname was printed in newspapers as Needy-Crudell, and she, her new husband, and that one son, Charles, faced the gallows as the summer of 1923 bore down on Chicago. But while Peter and Charlie faced a jury of their peers, Sabell faced a jury of men who not only had little sympathy for a woman suspected of killing her husband, but didn't even speak her language. And here's the thing, no one spoke Sabell's language. Everyone assumed that she spoke Italian, so Italian speakers were brought in to translate, but she actually spoke an Italian dialect called Barisi, primarily spoken in the heel part of Italy's boot. Now, you might be wondering just how different Barisi could possibly be from other Italian dialects. Lucchese has an answer.
I reached out to an expert in linguistics at Oxford University, and he said it is distinct as an English and a Dutch speaker trying to talk. So it's very, very hard, depending on what dialect of Italian the person speaks, how they can relate to somebody who speaks only Barese.
That's Lucchese speaking on an episode of Solved, posted by Author's Voice. Not only did Sabell's lawyers not speak her dialect, but her primary attorney, Eugene Moran, didn't speak any Italian at all. Not only that, but he was a bizarre character overall.
People haven't written a lot about Sabella, but when they did and they talked about Moran, they would call him as inept. It turns out he was more than that. And it turns out he spent the majority of the 1930s at an insane asylum in Wisconsin. So we see him unraveling during the trial. We see him at one point defending the prosecutor from the judge. We see him obsessing over whether the corpse was wearing underpants. And then he does, you know, he allows hearsay evidence. He's really confused.
You might be wondering why Sabell hired this guy. Well, she didn't.
He was the son of a very famous judge, and his full family was successful. So he was doing pretty small-time stuff. And one of the things he did was Sabella and her co-defendant had been accused of having an affair, and he defended her in that. And when he heard she was arrested, he just went to Cook County and took up that case.
So Sabella's main lawyer didn't speak her language and was mentally unstable, which was bad enough. But she was also kept from her co-defendant's son and also her uncharged children, any of whom could have translated the legal proceedings for her. The only son that was allowed access to her reportedly hated her guts. We don't know why. Which in turn meant she had no idea what was happening to her throughout her trial. Now, this language barrier also allowed for Dasso and Smith to get a quote-unquote implied confession from Sabelle, this time with the help of Sabelle's oldest son, James. That's the one who hated her. On the stand, James said as much, that he did not love his mother. He also said that he had overheard his brother Charlie tell the state's attorney the real story of their father's death. He said that his brother said that Peter Crudell had approached Francesco with a hammer, and when Charlie knocked it from his hand, Sabelle had raced to pick it up and hand it back to Peter. If you're wondering why James would say something like that, he apparently stood to inherit the most if his father were dead and his mother and other brother Charlie were out of the picture. Anyway, when Sheriff Dasso took the stand, he backed up James's story, saying he also heard Charlie tell this tale to the state's attorney. Dasso, who we'll just say doesn't have a great reputation with historians when it comes to moral fortitude or truth-telling, also told the court that he was confident Sabelle understood every word he said during the interrogation. He contended that she was only faking that "I only speak Barisi" nonsense. Awaiting that trial, Sabelle was housed in the Cook County Jail on a cell block commonly called Murderous Row. If this is starting to sound familiar, it should. A character very, very loosely based on Sabelle is in the musical Chicago and is the in the amazing song Cell Block Tango. Now, I'm no singer, so here's Broadway superstar and fellow Obsessed Network podcaster Ellen Marsh to sing the part for you.
Uh-uh.
In the movie version, the character on screen is lithe, blonde, Hungarian, her story told through ballet steps that are delicate and beautiful. Sabelle was none of those things. She was, in fact, constantly attacked in the press for her appearance.
They called her ugly. They called her a crouching animal.
She's not making that up. One reporter who targeted Sabelle was Genevieve Forbes, who wrote for the Chicago Tribune. In a July 10th, 1923 article, Forbes described Sabelle as a, quote, dumb, crouching, animal-like Italian peasant, end quote. She continued, saying Sabelle, quote, grew hysterical with the frenzied pleading of a cruel animal that has been cornered and tortured by a new kind of trap, end quote. Clearly already convinced that Sabelle and Peter were guilty, Forbes wrote that the Sabelle she saw in the courtroom was, quote, not the calm human who held her husband's head in her gnarled hands, while her lover, 23 years her junior, pounded the sleeping farmer over the head with a 6-pound hammer, end quote. I mean, the descriptions of this woman were brutal. We're talking phrases like stubby fingers where the dirt was ingrained into broken nails, matted hair, stocky legs, I'm not even done, seamy-faced, weather-beaten peasant, at home in a truck garden but little used to the refinement of even the stiff wooden chair in which she hunches restlessly. In comparison, the other women of Murderess Row were routinely described as sultry, sensuous, with rosily tinted nails, or in one case, quote, the prettiest murderess Cook County has ever known, end quote. That latter one, by the way, came from Maureen Watkins, the journalist who wrote the play Chicago in the 1920s. She had covered some of the Murderess Row cases alongside several colleagues, including Genevieve Forbes, who was the worst when it came to descriptions of Sabelle. The press's treatment of Sabelle was ugly enough that the other inmates on her block felt the need to write a letter in her defense. To no one's surprise, Genevieve Forbes' article focused on the generosity of the other women rather than the role she played in the bullying of Sibel. Forbes immediately called Peter Crudell Sibel's illicit lover. Though there was no evidence of any affair before Francesco's death, and they seem to have gotten married to avoid being accused of illicit behavior, but so it goes. The biggest issue throughout Forbes' article was that she called the other women on the cell block normal women, saying that the time waiting on the cell block made, quote, normal women out of the ladies behind the bars at the county jail yesterday, end quote. The implication is that not only are all the other inmates ladies who are lowered into normal women status, but Sibel is neither. Forbes went so far as to call the women's affection for Sibel, quote, primitive loyalty to a forlorn sister, down and out and homely, end quote. Isn't it so sweet that the pretty girls are standing up for their butt-ugly sister? Forbes added in some racism for good measure, essentially saying, can you believe these kind, helpful, lily-white-born murderesses were willing to help a poor peasant immigrant woman in need? Now, before I get letters and emails, let me explain. Today, Italian would generally be considered white, but not so in 1923. In that time period, with venom toward immigrants at a fever pitch, lots of people who fall under today's definition of white didn't back then. Irish immigrants, for example, Jewish people, Italians. There are multiple sources on this, including Nell Irvin Painter's book, The History of White People, but I digress. Now, there was another way to view Sibel besides as a dirty animal. Take, for example, what Emily Lucchese saw when she looked at photos of the dark-haired woman.
I saw her as a very scared individual.
Sibel had reason to be scared.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
By the time Sibel Needy found herself in jail, awaiting trial in the murder of her husband, she'd already had a rough life. And that includes her marriage to Francesco, who was straight-up abusive. The two had gotten married when she was 15 and he was about 27. Now, we don't know a lot about Francesco. Any Googling for the name will bring up results for a mobster.
When he asked that something be done, you did it. If you didn't, there would be hell to pay.
That's an A&E documentary talking about the mobster Frank Needy, who, like Francesco, was an Italian immigrant. That Needy rose to fame as Al Capone's first cousin and bodyguard. By the time he died by suicide in 1943, he was pretty famous. Not so our Francesco Needy. It's tough to find much about him online at all. His wife, Sibel, is a tad better documented, but really, not by much. Anyway, Italian heritage aside, what both Frank Needys had in common was apparently violence.
He was very violent. He was a drinker. He fought with his sons. He hit her.
That might sound like motive for murder, but in actuality, Sibel was reportedly frantic after her husband vanished.
I think in modern times, a lot of people would say good riddance, but it was her way of life. It's what she knew.
Once she reached America, her husband was her lifeline. He's the reason she didn't need to learn English. She was lost without him. All she knew was her farm and her family. That's probably why she threw herself into keeping the farm afloat after Francesco disappeared, right up until the time his body was found in a storm drain near the Needy property in Stickney, 9 months after he'd last been seen. The body was so badly decomposed that it could only be identified by a ring that Francesco was known to wear. Sabelle was just as lost months later at the trial, which was underscored by the fact that when the judge gave the jurors instructions before deliberating, she sat at the defendant's table looking bewildered, not understanding a word being said about her fate. The article that appeared in the Chicago Tribune said that Sabelle, quote, twisted her face in a grotesque angle of fear and inferiority and cruelty and hope, end quote. After only 2 hours of deliberating, the jury returned with a guilty verdict. Sentenced to hang, Sabelle was taken back to the prison, still without an interpreter to explain her fate. When she did learn what was going to happen to her, she began to scream. The Chicago Tribune quotes her as saying, "They choke me." She also reportedly attempted to take her own life twice that day. Charles escaped the noose, but Peter Crudell was set to be the 89th prisoner hanged at the Cook County gallows, with Sabelle in the books scheduled to be the 90th. She would also have the distinction of being the 13th Italian hanged and the first woman executed by Cook County. For the record, the first woman executed in all of Illinois was a woman named Elizabeth Reed, who supposedly poisoned her husband in 1845, but Sabelle was the first woman ever to be sentenced in Cook County specifically. She had a lot going against her.
At the time, you know, Italian Americans in the 1920s were seen as invaders. This is after World War I. We have changing quotas regarding immigrants from Southern Europe. And then who the Italian Americans were in Chicago. And that was, at the time, the most violent ethnic group, statistically.
The public was in the throes of the post-Great War Red Scare, see? So they were less than sympathetic of immigrants, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, like, you know, Italy. The xenophobia warred with the patriarchal discomfort of executing women. In her book, Lucchese refers to this as the Surratt effect, named after Mary Surratt, the only woman executed for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Chicago women's clubs worked together to do what they could, which was to hire a new attorney for Sabelle. After 18 days on the job, the attorney, Leo Shankstone, which is such a good name, filed a writ of habeas corpus on the grounds that the law used to condemn Sabelle used gendered language. If the law used only male pronouns, he argued, they could not be applied to a female defendant. Judge Michael McKinley was so insulted by the attorney's petition that he walked out of the courtroom and didn't return. Shankstone waited for a while before he realized he was sunk and left the courtroom too. Others petitioned the governor to commute Sabelle's sentence, but as she maintained her innocence, that would mean she still spend the rest of her life in prison. She had two young daughters who had spent the trial in the care of others. Even if her life was spared, she would not be able to see her daughters grow up. By August, her execution date was looming, and all of the efforts proposed by the women's clubs of Chicago had failed. Enter Helen Charisse, a 23-year-old lawyer and partner in the firm Benelli, Quilici, and Charisse. Helen's parents moved from Italy to Illinois in the 1880s, making her a first-generation American. One of five women in her class at DePaul University Law School in 1920, she had to wait almost a year until she turned 21 to take the Illinois bar. The same Chicago press that tore Sabelle down for her appearance attacked Helen for the opposite reason. She was traditionally beautiful. This paradox always infuriates me. As a woman, you're screwed if you're pretty and if you're not. At least one newspaper ran a photo of Helen with the word ambitious printed underneath, next to a photo of a socialite who had just become engaged. A subtle dig at Helen for not conforming to traditional gender roles. Ambitious is bad. Determined and proud of her heritage, Charisse connected with other Italian lawyers to form the Justinian Society of Lawyers. This organization was created to help Italians break through the upper echelon of Chicago society and also help their fellow countrymen and women who needed legal aid. Charisse and her partners discussed the risks of taking on Sabelle's case. If they lost and Sabella was executed, their firm would be forever connected to a very public failure. Recognizing the importance of the case, Helen rallied the team of six, all founding members of the Justinian League. The consensus was for Helen to reach out to Sabella and gain her trust, because if she couldn't get Sabella and Peter to trust the team, the appeal was over before it could even start. While the team's members were all Italian and likely had knowledge of various dialects, none spoke Barisi. They tried to figure out a few words here and there, but the bulk of the learning was put on Sabella. And she was up to the challenge. By the time of her first meeting with Charisse, she had picked up enough English from the other inmates to string together a few sentences. Communication was difficult, but Charisse's presence was reassuring to Sabella after more than a year of hostility from so many people. Charisse often brought Margaret Benelli, the wife of her law partner, with her on visits. Margaret, as the only non-attorney, inmate, or prison official Sabella had been able to talk to, became another source of comfort and compassion, two things dramatically lacking from Sabella's life. On August 4th, the team filed its first motion to replace the original legal team with the team of six. Once that was done, they immediately tried to file a motion to vacate the sentence, but the judge threw down a gauntlet from the bench. Quote, "I will consent to hear you, but there is not one chance in 100 the sentence will be vacated and a new trial granted," end quote. As the disheartened team left the courtroom, they had just weeks before the execution date to try to save Sabella.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Now, Sabella Needy's first murder trial was well covered by media of the day. What got far less coverage were the circumstances surrounding her husband's death and the investigation that followed. After Francesco's body was found, word got back to Cook County Sheriff's deputies who began their search in Stickney, doing the usual, looking for clues or evidence or witnesses that the missing persons investigation had missed. Keep in mind, they were already under the assumption that they knew who had killed Francesco, but they did hope to figure out the why and also find some evidence to shore up a conviction. That was the investigation presented in the original trial. With Sabella's new legal team, a new investigation got underway. Several witnesses told them that before he disappeared, Francesco had appeared bloodied and bruised and said that one of his sons, Michael, had assaulted him. Now, reminder, the son who was arrested was Charles. The one who testified against Sabella was James. This is a different son. Anyway, possible theories were bandied about. Maybe Francesco was humiliated by this confrontation with his son and decided to abandon his whole family. Or maybe he had thought he was okay after this pummeling, but died of internal injuries somewhere in a storm drain. In addition to new information and new witnesses, the team also got affidavits from Peter and Sabella, who could speak more English now. That allowed her to tell of everything she had been through. How she didn't understand the questions that were posed to her, that the sheriff tried to get her to confess by promising she'd avoid prison because she's a woman and a mother, the fact that no one had actually told her that her husband had even been murdered, and no one had bothered to ask her any questions during the first trial, so she never had an opportunity to say that she actually never confessed to anything. She also explained that she never hired her first legal team, that her attorney, Eugene Moran, had simply shown up and claimed her case. Her affidavit was now able to clear all of that up. Peter's affidavit matched Sabella's on all the details. Charisse took her clients and the affidavits to a hearing being held that same day. At a court hearing, Charisse introduced those affidavits and called several witnesses, including the chief of police. While the chief was in the middle of being questioned, the judge inexplicably halted his testimony. The team pivoted, saying that their initially awful defense team entitled Sabelle and Peter to a new trial, but the judge shut that down too. According to Judge David, quote, "The crime was the most atrocious and committed deliberately and with apparent loss of all heart and feeling. The motion is overruled. I feel that I am doing the right thing for the community and civilization by doing so," end quote. The team's next step was to file a writ of error with the Illinois Supreme Court. The writ, which identified 18 errors in the original trial, would stay the execution until a higher court could review the case. If the writ had been denied, Sabelle and Peter were to be executed within 3 weeks. But that didn't happen. On September 25th, 1923, Justice Orrin Carter signed a writ staying both executions until the Supreme Court gave further notice, giving the team of six the one thing they needed, more time. Charisse immediately went to Cook County Jail to tell Sabelle and Peter the good news. Sabelle's language skills made it so she didn't understand. Peter began to cry in relief, which led her to think that they had lost the fight. For Peter and Sabelle, who had been behind bars for months, that was the only good news. The docket of the Supreme Court was incredibly busy, and they were not expected to get to the Needy Credell case until at least February of 1924. By then, Sabelle would have spent at least 9 months in jail. But in Charisse's mind, the time was perfect. Her plan to save Sabelle also included something that her male colleagues never would have considered: a makeover. Sabelle, a hard-working woman who had built muscles after years of farm labor, lay outside the standards of beauty, as the newspaper said. The sun had damaged her skin, her hair was streaked with gray and pulled back in a severe bun to keep it out of her face, and she was painfully thin after months in prison. Charisse brought a hairstylist to the prison to begin the transformation. Color was applied to get rid of the gray and give the hair an even chestnut tone. While her long tied back hair was practical on a farm, in 1923-24, it was symbolic of a bygone era. Sabelle needed to be modernized. Her hair was cut into a bob with bangs and styled in soft waves. Charisse brought in makeup and taught Sabelle how to apply it. It's a bizarre scene to imagine. Locks of gray streaked hair falling to the floor as a stylist stepped around Sabelle. It's a typical spa day scene, but this time there wasn't much fun about it. It was a life-saving endeavor.
The hair was cut, dyed, bobbed, makeup.
The last piece of the makeover was to thoroughly clean and soften Sabelle's hands. Her hands were a specific target of the press, so it was important to remember them in her makeover. But those weren't the only pieces to Charisse's plan. They were just the most public. It's believed that Charisse and Margaret Bonelli snuck in meals to Sabelle to help her gain weight. In jail, her meals had been limited to a bread roll and an occasional cup of soup, but Sabelle, who'd been a hard worker her whole life, insisted on working in the prison and therefore burned far more calories than she ate.
She was emaciated.
The extra food helped get rid of her sunken eyes and hollow cheeks. Sabelle also now had the time to learn more English and American mannerisms.
She was really an intelligent woman because she learned to speak English, and she did so without knowing how to read or write.
As Sabelle practiced her English, she waited for movement in her case. The first hope was the possibility of a bail hearing. But while she waited for a hearing, Chicago crime exploded. The two women the characters Velma and Roxy are based on in the musical Chicago committed their crimes and were arrested. As soon as they arrived at the prison, glamorous and exciting, Sabelle was backburnered again. Then, in May of 1924, Leopold and Loeb killed Bobby Franks in the quote-unquote crime of the century. Chicago and the Cook County court system had much more exciting things to concentrate on rather than Sabelle. It wasn't until June 17, 1924, that Sabelle finally got her bail hearing. The judge set her bail at $12,500. That's $220,000 in today's money. Her legal team put up bail and papers were signed immediately. Reporters in attendance took note that while Sabelle was not able to sign her affidavit months earlier, she was able to make her mark on her bail paperwork. She also spoke enough English to answer the judge's questions, showing the press her transition to an English speaker. In stories about her release, it was reported that Sabelle was going to return to the farm in Stickley she had shared with her husband. What they, and perhaps she, didn't know was that her sons had squandered the farm away in the year she was in prison. She had absolutely nothing except what her legal team provided for her and her two young daughters. Cherise encouraged Sabelle to talk to the press at any opportunity in an effort to finally win them over. The tactic seemed to be working by fall 1924. Rather than being described as a crouching animal, Sabelle was instead a, quote, woman in her recovery from her torturous experience, end quote. Any gray hairs that appeared were now reframed as a symptom of the stress she'd endured during her horrifying ordeal. Cherise and Sabelle worked the press until December 1924, when the court pressured the prosecutor's office to make a decision in the case. With no new evidence, the prosecutor was forced to drop all charges. As more proof that her marriage to Crudell was purely one of convenience, it ended as soon as the charges were dropped. In the 1930 United States Census, Sabelle is listed as a widow and was still using the name Needy. Moving on with her life, she married for the third and final time to Giuseppe Campobasso, another immigrant from the Bari area, on November 2, 1940. Within the year, she applied for citizenship and got it 5 years later. Her daughters now grown and with families of their own, Sabelle and Giuseppe moved to California, where she died at the age of 77 on December 10, 1957. If you're curious who really killed Francesco Needy, it was likely one of her sons, though not the one who'd been arrested for it. More detailed reports of him fighting with that other son, James, came out after Sabelle's acquittal, but no one else was ever charged with a crime. Sabelle was one of many women who sat on Murderess Row in Cook County Jail and in the musical Chicago. In fiction and reality, all others were given a voice, the ability to speak in their own defense. Sabelle was openly criticized, mocked, and prosecuted by the press. Sometimes, in retellings of the more famous women's cases, Sabelle's is still summarized inaccurately. This is from an episode of Drunk History, so forgive the screaming. They're, you know, drunk.
Meanwhile, Sabelle Needy
got hanged.
In real life, she didn't. But the character in Chicago based on her did. In fact, that whole character and its dramatic hanging exists in the play solely to convince Roxy Hart that this being accused of murder business is serious and she had better go back to her lawyer, Billy Flynn. I mean, really, both in reality and in fiction, all iterations of Sabelle have been treated differently from the other women on Murderess Row. But especially the real-life version. The why behind this are varied. She was the only immigrant and the only one not considered white by the racial definition of the day. She was the only one deemed animalistic and uncultured and stupid because she didn't speak English, which surely played a role in her being the only one found guilty. And, strangest fact of all, she was the only one whose life largely was spared by something as trivial as a makeover. To research this story, I got help from a historian, Jennifer Erdman, assistant professor and chair of the History and Political Science Department of Notre Dame of Maryland University, did the initial research. tapping info from contemporary news coverage and also Emily Lucchese's book, Ugly Prey, An Innocent Woman and the Death Sentence That Scandalized Jazz Age Chicago. Erdman also helped write the script, and I'm happy to say will be helping out more because she loves this stuff, and she says she hopes to convince the Obsessed Network to hire a staff historian. P.S. I did some work too. Crimes of the Centuries is a production of the Obsessed Network. To learn more about its shows, go to obsessednetwork.com. This episode was written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Jennifer Swatek. Steve Tipton edited the script. Original music is by Bruce Hunt and Andrew Higley. Other music comes from Blue Dot Sessions and Universal Music Productions. If you like us, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram and Twitter, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.